From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. In one of his Sherlock Holmes novels, Arthur Conan Doyle writes that detection is or ought to be an exact science. But whether exact or scientific, millions of readers would agree about the pleasures of detective fiction. Where does the whodunit originate? What are some of its noteworthy literary and philosophical underpinnings? Why do people read detective fiction? In the first of two discussions, Soundings put those and related questions to three recent visitors at the National Humanities Center, Robert B. Parker, Ann Ponder, and Amanda J. Smith. Robert Parker is the creator of Spencer, a contemporary Boston detective. Mr. Parker's Spencer novel, entitled Promised Land, won the Edgar Award in 1976. Ann Ponder is a scholar of detective fiction. She directs the honors program at Elon College, where she teaches courses in literature and film. Amanda J. Smith is the author of two detective novels, Death is Academic and Death on the Eno. The discussion begins with comments by Ann Ponder.
I suppose that what W.H. Auden says about detective fiction would be a literate place to begin, at least. He has an essay called The Guilty Vicarage, and he describes detective fiction as being a dialectic between innocence and guilt. And he explains that the appeal to scientists and people who love literature and all sorts of persons has to do with the inherent sense of guilt in each of those people, and confesses to that himself, and talks about writers like Raymond Chandler as being writers of serious great art.
Well, this sounds as though you are describing a strong, what would you call it, theological dimension, spiritual dimension. Does this, Auden's notion here, does this have a sort of an implicit assumption about human nature?
I think so, and more so in hard-boiled or more recent kinds of detective fiction, where the world is recognized as corrupted, as fallen, as not the sort of simple place that one can remove the evil from and fold. Fold it back in on itself as if it were somehow completed or finished or something like that. Part of what goes on in Bob Parker's novels and in Amanda McKay's novels are what it means, an investigation of what it means to be a good human being and how people go about doing that in the corrupt world.
Bob Parker, do you think that your man Spencer is moral insofar as he reacts to what you might call a fallen world, putting him into this Auden-like context?
Raymond Chandler said about Philip Marlowe that he had the moral sense of a horse. I will just allude to that in partial answer to your question. I think that part of what Auden was talking about in The Guilty Vicarage was the contrast between guilt and vicarages. That is, the title suggested both the form and tradition of what, for lack of a better word, I would call a ratiocinative detective story, in that for writers of ratiocinative detective fiction, crime is seen as an aberration from the norm.
Let's have a little footnote here. Ratiocinative.
The use of reason, as in Sherlock Holmes being the most classic exemplar. It's an attitude about life, I suppose, which derives out of the 18th century, which perceives the universe as a kind of intelligent machine created by a reasonable God, in which crime is a deviation and a malfunction of that machine. Man, being intellectual and reasonable, can restore the natural order of things by fixing the machine and expunging the crime. And so the garden and the vicarage becomes once again orderly, so that the alternate way of looking at life in detective fiction is a kind of working definition of my own, is in the American hard-boiled traditional stuff, say an exemplar being Hammett or Chandler or moi, that means me in French. The world is seen as post-lapsarian, let us say, and it is perceived as Ann Ponder described it, As fallen and corrupt, it is not a rational place. It cannot be fixed by rational endeavors. And the detective, in fact, frequently doesn't fix it at all. Because he is strong enough and tough enough, he may remain himself at least moderately uncorrupted.
The kind of book that I tried to write, I thought about the books that I liked to read, and I don't read the blood and guts ones. I don't want to pay somebody to brutalize me. I read the Christie, Allingham, Niall Marsh kinds of books, and I think what they offer is a very ordered world, a very reliable world in which the I also was struck by your remarks about crime being a deviation. I think one of the things those books say is that crime is not a deviation. It's a standard part of the world, but it's controllable. And I think that people read those stories because they're comforting.
Yeah, how is it controllable, Amanda McKay? That is, by what technique?
You can't stop it from happening, but I think that the whodunit is perhaps the only socially acceptable story left with a happy ending.
And how is the happy ending achieved, though? That's what I'm asking.
By solving a problem.
How?
By finding out whodunit.
Intellectually. Reasonably,
yes.
Rather than, say, physically.
Yes, that's right.
They triumph through reason rather than strength, as it were.
And there are conventions which are comforting.
Mm-hmm.
The reader of a whodunit feels very put upon if the author has not followed the rules.
So that it is a predictable and relatively orderly world in which the whodunit functions.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas what you would call blood and guts detective story inhabits a world which is neither predictable nor orderly, and in which things are solved not intellectually but physically, to make a distinction and work with two different kinds of definitions.
Yeah, I'd agree with that, although I think from what you were saying earlier that they're not always solved. Whereas I think that there's a great feeling that you must tie up all the ends in the other kind of story.
Mm-hmm, I agree.
There's, for instance, the convention of the scene in which the protagonist explains how everything was figured out,
mm-hmm.
and refers back to the clues that have been dropped along in chapters 3, 5, and 9, so that the reader doesn't feel cheated with. And I think all of that is comforting.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Would you call this, whether it's blood and guts or whether it is reasonable, ratiocinative, would you call this escapism? Is there, for instance, Ann Ponder, a theory of detective fiction, blood and guts or reasonable?
First, let me respond metaphorically to try to make the distinction between the two types of fiction we're talking about. In one of them, you might even call it puzzle fiction, where the function is to get all the pieces so that the picture comes out and it's finished at some point.
Now, when you say you mean the reader.
It's a parallel activity. And that's one of the things that's interesting for a reader. The detective and the reader do a parallel construction, and the moment at which the detective and the reader both know how it's going to work out is one of those rewarding moments for mm-hmm. those who read detective puzzle fiction, like Amanda McKay was referring to. The other half of the metaphor, though, is for American hard-boiled detective fiction as a tradition, is that the pieces don't fit, that they are random and they move around when you're not looking, and that you assemble, or the detective and the reader together, assemble a certain number of them that recur as touchstones or seem to be selected as being appropriate or good. It's charm as a kind of reader, for a kind of readership, is that individual people, by what they do and what they can figure out, make some difference. And that happens in both of these kinds of fiction. And it's a really very romantic notion in them both, that somehow an individual human can, either by figuring it out in the puzzle fiction, or by acting in a certain way, or that a fairly ordinary person without extraordinary advantages of wealth or prestige or whatever can do right or can do well in the context of the world.
I don't think that the question is a matter of happiness. I think that detective stories are romances in the sense that Northrop Frye used the term. And I think that my working definition of a detective novel is simply that it is fiction in which the protagonist is a detective. Beyond that, I've never had the sense that I'm working in a form. nor that I am either required to or prohibited from. I am simply trying to write in my own work, successfully or not, about honor and about love, and I think that probably the detective story as practiced by people like Chandler and Hammett in some ways is as much about the question of honor as it is about anything. It is in mind to the extent that I'm successful. And I think that it is not a question so much that a man can prevail and therefore find happiness, but that a person, male or female, can prevail insofar as he or she is not finally overwhelmed by a corrupt place. And that in that is honor and a kind of private commitment. I think it grows out of the forces that produced the whole post-World War I era, that the world is not a welcoming place, and morality, ethics, behavior, how we do things, how we think, how we live, are not learnable from the structures of society, but are intuited from somewhere within, so that people finally develop perhaps a moral sense in the way that James would see people having a moral sense, the way you have an aesthetic sense. I think that's what it's about.
I'd like to ask Bob Parker why you think people read the Blood and Guts novels, which I just slightly snootily said I didn't read, although I'd read some.
Yeah, and I think probably we need to define Blood and Guts a little bit, though I don't particularly have the energy to do it right now. It's a sort of pejorative description, and I'm not sure it needs to be. Hemingway is blood and gutsy, and so is Faulkner, for instance, and so is Shakespeare, in that there is blood and guts abounding in all of those writers. I think that I can't say why people read books. I think it is an error that most of us make. John Kenneth Galbraith once said about economists, they make predictions not because they know, but because they're asked. And I think that for writers to talk about what the audience does and why they do it it falls into that same category. We sold 250,000 copies of Ceremony in paperback last year. Of those 250,000, I suspect there are a number of very different reasons why people chose to buy and read the book. If I have to generalize, and I suppose by volunteering to do this I've agreed to, I would guess that people are interested in the image of a hero who was finally coherent, self-disciplined, reasonably autonomous, able to control his fear of death, his desire for sex and money, and finally free of those constraints which most of us are not free of. And in that image, like the image of the Westerner, or the image of the Arthurian knight, the reader finds some consolation, some temporary stay against confusion.
I really liked your remark that honor is an important part of it, because I think that one of the things that's interesting that goes on in both kinds of detective story is that it is a place where you can moralize unsentimentally. There's a convention, for instance, in the puzzle story, in which the worldly detective explains to somebody why murder is really not a very good idea.
Mm-hmm.
It usually comes in the context of somebody suggesting that they think the murdered person is well off gone, and perhaps we should just forget it. And then the detective explains that, you know, really after you've murdered, you're inclined to think that it's all right to go around murdering, and you're likely to do it again, and we can't forget it, we've got to pursue it. And I think that people are happy in a world that has grown sort of fashionably cynical, to have it be okay to have someone say, no, you ought to be honorable, you shouldn't murder. If somebody has, you ought to find out who did it. The almost nursery values that we have thought weren't fashionable and have therefore denied ourselves.
We began talking about your notions of detective fiction, Amanda McCain, Bob Parker, Ann Ponder, and we talked about audience. Bob Parker, what about you? What do you hear about your man Spencer from your readers?
I hear that they want me to be just like him.
Does this depress or amuse you, or something beyond that?
Well, it doesn't do any of those things. I'm beyond that, Wayne Pond. I'm in deep into ennui. But anyway, what we can talk about in terms of that is quite simply that the assumption that you look around you and take a character and base him on somebody else is to rob us, Amanda McKay and myself and everyone else who does this sort of thing for a living, of the sine qua non of our profession, that is imagination. And it is inexplicable to a great many people that I do not necessarily have somebody in mind when I write a character that I made that character up. A great many people want to know if I've ever been a cop, that sort of thing. No, I never have. As Henry James once said, you take a little imagination, it matters less what your experience is than what you have done with it.
Amanda McKay?
You do make the character up, but to a great extent, the character makes itself up. I have been fascinated at how little control I have over them. My process is that I first decide what the essential problem of the book is and who done it and why they done it. And I then decide. Then I people their world. I decide who their family and friends are, and so forth. And I try to get to know those people before I do any writing. And then after I do know them, they go ahead and run their own lives. And when I find, I'm starting a new chapter, I don't ordinarily say to myself, now what do I want to have happen next? I say, well, what would she do next? And she goes ahead and does it with remarkable autonomy, I think. Sometimes they do things that I find perfectly marvelous, that I couldn't have made up on purpose if I'd wanted to. And sometimes they do things that irritate the dickens out of me, and I either leave it or I don't leave it, depending on how authoritarian I'm feeling that day. But I don't feel that I'm sort of deliberately making things up, but rather that I've created the world and let it run.
Yeah, my experience is different. They never do anything that surprises me. I am the sole owner and proprietor of all of them. I make everything up. I imagine it all. I try to make them act consistent with the characters I've given them and the impulses and humanity that I've invested them with, but they do not have a life of their own, except to speak metaphorically. And everything they do because I have imagined that they ought to. It is, as I say, it seems to me, the one, you take experience, you filter it through imagination, and out comes fiction.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to the first of two discussions about detective fiction, its practice and audiences. The panelists are two authors and a scholar of detective fiction, Robert B. Parker, Ann Ponder, and Amanda J. Smith. Robert Parker is the author of many detective novels. He's the creator of Spencer, a modern-day detective based in Boston. Mr. Parker has also written screenplays and books about sports. Ann Ponder is a critic and scholar of detective fiction. She teaches courses in literature and film at Elon College, where she also directs the honors program. Amanda J. Smith has written two detective novels, Death is Academic and Death on the Eno.
Ann Ponder, let me ask you to comment on an issue that Bob Parker and Amanda McKay have been talking around here for a few moments. Is detective fiction art? Does it deserve high literary praise? Should it be dismissed as simply a popular pastime unworthy of serious literary study, criticism?
I think it's serious fiction. I think it's serious literature. And the simply that it has certain formulaic conventions as part of what happens is not something that should disqualify it in any way as serious fiction. Some of what is done in this genre is some of the best fiction that has been written in this century. In some ways, to suggest that it's better or worse than other things that you might suggest are serious fiction is to compare two things that really aren't very similar. It would be like comparing a flute solo with a symphony and saying which one makes the top 10 or which one is best. They are both good. They are different in terms of what they are. To suggest that Faulkner, who I think is a particularly great writer of serious fiction, is a better writer than someone else who may have dealt with this particular genre, like a Joseph Conrad in The Secret Agent, is not very useful.
Amanda McKay?
At the risk of sounding a little bit pretentious, I think that it is fun and useful to work within a form. And the pretentious bit is that it's like the sonnet. I don't suppose that anybody ever put Shakespeare down for sticking with sonnets. Well, of course, it wasn't the only thing he did, but nobody ever said this isn't a real poem because you have started out with an agreement that you're going to have a certain rhythm and a certain rhyme scheme and so forth. I enjoy working within the form. It answers certain questions that I then don't have to answer for myself. However, I do think that the writers who offer you nothing but the form are boring. And there are people who do that and do it, I'm sure, financially successfully, but over and over again, they only offer the form and nothing more. I don't get much fun out of reading those books after the first two or three. But if you take the form and then try to use it to say something or to show characters that are real to you or to pick up on Bob Parker's honor or whatever, then I think that using the form, let's see, it's a little bit like formal clothes. Men all get dressed up exactly the same, and then that enables you to concentrate on their faces. And I think that the form of detective fiction does the same sort of thing for you.
Amanda, a few minutes ago you said that you write your detective novels to amuse yourself, that you enjoy it. That cuts two ways. Is that a good or a bad thing to admit?
I don't see why you shouldn't have fun doing it. I don't know if Bob Parker thinks it's fun to do it or not, but I wouldn't do it if I didn't think it was fun.
Bob Parker doesn't think it's fun to do, though I wouldn't stop, even if people paid me to, so stop taking up a collection. It is hard work. And it is, it's comparable to a lot of things that are hard but worth doing. I run and I work out with weights. Both of those are hard work. I don't enjoy it. I don't rush to the track eagerly, nor to the Nautilus machinery. But if I don't do it, I miss it.
Well, Bob, is the hard part the writing itself or the imagining?
The two aren't separable.
Uh-huh.
So that I couldn't make the distinction. The hard part is putting Fanny in chair every day and knowing you're going to be there for several hours. Somebody said writers love distraction. I can't wait for the dog to bark or the mail to come. It's why I need, say, 5 hours of time to do 3 hours of writing.
Amanda, let me come back to the question of detective fiction and social concerns or causes. You describe yourself as a feminist. Is your character Hannah a feminist? And how important is that? In the mix of who done it, to whom, and who figures it out, and does the reader come away happy at the end of the book knowing this or that, having a strong or a weak sense of, in this case, feminism in your heroine or protagonist?
No, I don't understand the question. Nothing happens to it. You've used the form as the hanger to hang the suit on, and then it goes ahead and bees fiction.
There's nothing exclusionary here. What do the critics say, Anne Ponder? Is there a consensus or an agreement, disagreement about mixing into what apparently is very formulaic, a very conventional kind of writing, social causes, social relevance, for lack of a better term?
It depends on what access to originality you're going to permit your authors in this particular formula. What else they might include is certainly out of their own experience or out of their own creativity, and you have to give them some sort of way not to write simply a reproduction of the formula, but a way to use the form to manufacture, to make something else. Perhaps the best
Amanda thing to do- McKay is shaking her head. I want to hear what she has to say.
I was resisting the word manufacture. In my own mind, there are two quite separate things going on. One is the story, and the other is what's the book about. The book is not about who killed this person. For instance, in my second book, Death on the Eno, the book is about how do people feel about land. And you use that as the motivations and so forth, but it is not about who did it. You find out who did it at the end in order to tie the bow on the package the way you're supposed to. But that's not what the book's about.
Maybe a way to proceed with this, rather than to suggest the issue of other material, maybe to get Amanda McKay and Bob Parker to react to a quotation from Raymond Chandler. I think we're lucky here that we have representatives of each of the two kinds of detective fiction. Amanda McKay's work is more like the Christie, Sayers, Allingham puzzles fiction. And Bob Parker's is more like the American hard-boiled detective tradition that includes Hammett, Chandler, James Caine, Ross MacDonald, and others. Chandler, when he was asked about Agatha Christie's And Then There Were None, said that it resolved for him the issue of whether or not you could write an honest mystery or an honest detective story of that kind, and he thinks not. He says, "To get the complication, you fake the clues, the timing, the play of coincidence. You assume certainties where only 50% chances exist at most. To get the surprise murderer, you fake character, which hits me hardest of all because I have a sense of character."
Bob, do you want to take a crack at that?
Yes, I think that it's the same old problem of writers talking aloud in public when they should be home writing. I admire Chandler inordinately, but I don't think that one can generalize that one or another kind of art is honest or dishonest, nor can I even go so far as to say that a criterion of art should be honesty. It is all art is, after all, among other things, artifact. It is all contrivance. And whether or not Agatha Christie in this specific novel did this specific thing would be a real discussion. Whether or not it is typical of a whole phalanx of work of a certain kind, it seems to me, is something not worth pursuing in those terms, let alone the question of whether or not art has to be honest. Because we don't really have an altogether suitable definition of what we mean by art. We don't have a suitable definition of what we mean by detective fiction or the form. And while it is stimulating to talk about it, it is useful periodically to remember that we don't, at least not an agreed upon one, and that all the things that would make a good detective story will also make a good non-detective story. And it is difficult to come to concrete conclusions like that beyond the sort of self-serving, I have a sense of character. A lot of people do.
I can go along with a great deal in the quotation referring to that particular book, except the line, fake the character. I really don't think you can write a good book if you fake the character. As I mentioned earlier, I keep being asked whether the people that are in my books are real or not. They're not based on real people, but I hope they are themselves real people. And if the character is not integrated, it doesn't work, and it isn't fake. Now, I've made some things up in my books for artistic reasons or for reasons of plot, but I don't make up the characters. I think they have an integrity.
You've been listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond with the first of two discussions about detective fiction. The panelists were Robert B. Parker, a detective novelist who lives in Boston, Ann Ponder of Elon College, and Amanda J. Smith, a mystery novelist who lives in Durham, North Carolina. Next week, on part two of Soundings on Detective Fiction, Robert Parker, Ann Ponder, and Amanda Smith continue their discussion about the origins and practice of detective fiction. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join me this week for Three Pipe Problems, a discussion about the art of detective fiction. In the first of two segments on Soundings, two writers and a scholar of detective fiction discuss the origins of the whodunit, some of its literary and philosophical underpinnings, and explain why people read detective fiction. Two mystery novelists, Robert B. Parker of Boston and Amanda J. Smith of Durham, North Carolina, along with a scholar of detective fiction, Ann Ponder of Elon College, in a discussion about the art of detective fiction, part one, this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.